here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Today is Monday, August 27th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Martin Lemlin. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. Broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia and to UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to our listeners and of the newscast and podcast on CITR.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:05 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast, right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now it's time for your UBC and local headlines.
Starting in September, UBC professors will offer special one-day courses to share their interest in a range of topics, such as the Japanese tea ceremony, fashion history, Leonard Cohen, erotic art, horror movies, fevers, and ancient Mayan predictions of a December cataclysm. The courses are part of a unique effort by UBC Continuing Studies to promote liberal arts and lifelong learning. Marketing manager Tanya Reed said, quote, as far as we know, no other university in Canada or the US is offering one-day courses taught by their own faculty at their own campuses as an access program for the wider community, end quote. At 30, the number of courses offered this year is twice what it was in previous years, and more faculty members are teaching the continuing studies courses than ever before. The classes include Nightmare on Elm Street, The Anatomy of a Horror Movie Franchise, Democracy and Two-Party Politics in the United States, Global History of Fashion, Leonard Cohen, Poetry, Prose and Passion, The Organization of Violence, The Japanese Tea Ceremony, and The Crisis of the Eurozone. The courses cost $75 each, and run from 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. on one Saturday during September to December.
More than 100 people joined forces on Saturday to send a message to Ottawa to stop the upcoming closure of the Kitsilano Coast Guard Station. Politicians from the provincial NDP and the Green Party were in attendance, as well as the labor union reps and concerned citizens. Notably absent were the BC Liberals, although a statement from BC Attorney General Shirley Bond was also released at the event. It read that while the province understands that the current fiscal climate requires difficult budget decisions, public safety must be the guiding principle. BC Federation of Labor President Jim Sinclair said, quote, I want to be very clear, this station will not close, period. We are not giving Stephen Harper the option, end quote. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans announced in May that it was closing the Kitsilano Coast Guard, leaving only the Sea Island Coast Guard stationed at YVR. The federal government stated that BC has more lifeboat stations than any other province. The Kits station is expected to shut down at the end of the boating season.
More than $200,000 could be made at the BC Transit facility if commercial opportunities are allowed to flourish there in Whistler. On Tuesday, council moved with zoning amendments to pave the way for the first commercial operations at the BC Transit facility, perhaps setting the stage for more commercial operations at transit centers elsewhere in the province. The zoning changes will allow transit to rent bus parking, the diesel fueling station, and the bus washing station at a fee. The $23.5 million facility is underutilized, built for 50 buses with only 23 serving the Whistler community at the moment. The bus parking contract already secured by BC Transit as it will generate $40,000 per year. It deals with parking for one anchor tenant. The municipality will get $17,000 the first year, increasing to roughly $20,000 in later years. The money will go back into transit services in Whistler, as will BC Transit's cut of the money.
University of Victoria students going back to school in September could face administrative headaches as support staff prepare for possible job action later this week. Members of the Canadian Union of Public Employees, Locals 951 and 917, more than 1,300 support staff who work in libraries, provide child care, and tend to university grounds, serve strike notice on June 25th. Essential services hearings between the groups and the labor board finalizing minimal staffing levels in case of a strike took place last week. A ruling is expected Monday or Tuesday, at which point the locals may follow with job action. Workers have been without contracts since March 31st of 2010, when collective agreements for hundreds of thousands of the province's public sector workers expired. Sprenger's strike action will target administrative services rather than student services, and initial picket lines will occur at administrative buildings. He warns, however, that if the university does not return the bargaining table, expanded strike activity could affect students. UVic is one of four BC universities involved in strike mandates among support workers concerned about job security and wages. UBC's CUPE Local 2278 tendered a monetary offer from its employees Friday after a strike vote in March, while the University of Northern British Columbia passed a strike mandate in July and will begin another round of negotiations September 27th. Support staff workers at Thompson Rivers University are preparing for a strike vote between August 28th and September 6th.
The RCMP drug investigation that took nearly 2 years and involved authorities from Canada, the U.S., Panama, and Mexico has resulted in charges against 8 people, including top members of the Hells Angels motorcycle gang in British Columbia. The lengthy investigation, known as E-Predicate, led police to search 5 locations around BC over the weekend. The Hells Angels clubhouse in Kelowna was among the police targets. Officers seized an assault rifle, handguns, and nearly $4 million in cash. Mounds of that cash was on display as Superintendent Brian Cantera of the RCMP Drug Enforcement Branch in BC announced the charges to reporters on Monday. David Giles, a well-known vice president of the motorcycle gang's Kelowna chapter, was one of 7 people arrested on Saturday. Police say he was picked up in a Metro Vancouver casino and is now charged with conspiracy to import and traffic cocaine. Kelowna RCMP Superintendent Bill McKinnon said Saturday's arrests of some of the Hells Angels' most senior members have a huge implication for Kelowna, a city where he says 8 organized crime groups have, quote, firmly entrenched themselves in the community.
And those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for your local weather forecast as well as provincial and national headlines.
This year on This Fringy Life, life at the Vancouver International Fringe Festival is
spacey,
lonely, sexy,
untruthful,
mind-bending,
and over the edge.
Each week, on August 22nd, August 29th, and September 5th, we choose 2 themes and bring you stories on those themes. Tune in on Wednesdays at 6:30 after the Arts Report for This Fringy Life, brought to you by The Arts Report and distributed by CITR 101.9 Vancouver. Download the podcasts at www.citr.ca.
Want to be a kidney hero? Don't know how? It's simple. Join the Kidney Walk in August. Walkers are invited to join friends, family, and neighbors to walk. Bring pledges and take the first steps in becoming a kidney hero by registering to be an organ donor. For more information on how and when you can be a kidney hero, visit www.kidney.bc.ca. That's www.kidney.bc.ca. Be a hero. Save lives. Register.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
It's now time for your provincial and national headlines.
Owning a home became even more financially challenging for BC households for the second consecutive quarter in 2012, according to a latest housing trends and affordability report issued today by RBC Economics Research. In particular, Vancouver was highlighted for its extreme prices. The report is based on the cost of owning a detached bungalow at market value. The affordability reading percent is the amount of a typical household's monthly pre-tax income home ownership costs, including mortgage payments, utilities, and property taxes, and so on. Vancouver's home ownership costs were 91% of pre-tax income, which is a 2.2% increase from last quarter. Other notable cities include Toronto at 54.5%, Ottawa at 41.9%, Montreal at 40.4%, and Calgary at 36.7%.
The Canada Post group of companies said Monday that losses deepened in the second quarter as Canadians mailed fewer packages, eroding results across most of its operations. The company reported a loss of $10 million, or $4 million after taxes, which marks an improvement from a loss of $18 million, or $17 million after taxes, last year. But the Crown Corporation says the latest quarter compares favorably largely due to a lockout last summer, which pulled down the results of comparable period last year, making the decline in the latest quarter seem less severe. Mail volumes were down 4.4%, while the cost of operations rose 6.1%. The company noted that 71% of its overall costs were tied to labor, which is why it believes it's important to reach a collective agreement with the union representing its employees. John Hamilton, Canada Post Director of Communications, said, quote, "It's time for us to have some realistic discussions based on the current realities we now face. The decline of mail is not something that's going to rebound. Canadians are using Canada Post in different ways. Their expectations of what Canada Post can offer are different, and we need to adjust for that," end quote. Hamilton said that Canada Post gave its most recent offer to the Canadian Union for Postal Workers on July 19th. The Crown Corporation locked out some 50,000 of its employees last summer after a series of rotating strikes. The dispute ended with the federal back-to-work legislation that forced workers to accept wages that amounted to less than Canada Post's last offer.
The Canadian government said it will allow some livestock producers to defer income tax on the sale of breeding animals for 1 year, as the eastern provinces of Ontario and Quebec cope with drought. Hot, dry weather this summer drastically reduced feed supplies for some Canadian farmers, forcing them to liquidate their herds. The tax deferral allows farmers to redirect money towards replenishing next year's breeding stock, Agricultural Minister Jerry Ritz said on Monday. Farmers in drought-stricken areas will be allowed to defer taxes on 30% of income from net sales if they have reduced their breeding herds by at least 15%. Farmers whose herds have been reduced by more than 30% can defer 90% of income from their net sales.
The New Democratic Party of Canada has been forced to pay back over $340,000 it received in ad revenue. The federal NDP collected the money from eight unions to post their logos at several of the party's conventions over the past 6 years. Elections Canada forced the NDP to pay the money back, saying that such monetary contributions should be counted as sponsorship, not ad revenue, and accepting such sponsorship funding from a union is illegal for political parties. The NDP paid the money back in April and May, but did so quietly. It wasn't until the Toronto Star broke the story yesterday that the amounts of money involved were disclosed publicly. In her party's defense, Libby Davies said that the ad revenue sponsorship mix-up was an honest mistake and applauded the NDP for promptly paying the money back, while opposition members are criticizing the NDP not only for breaking the rules, but for failing to disclose the amount of money involved to the public.
A Liberal senator has been allowed to continue in her duties despite being declared legally incompetent. Senator Joyce Fairbairn was diagnosed with dementia in February. By April, an aide to Liberal Senate leader James Cowan had co-signed a declaration that Fairbairn was legally incompetent, but the veteran senator was still allowed to vote on legislation and spend public dollars until the end of the spring session. Now, with the Senate due to reconvene in September, and with Senator Fairbairn's condition worsening, questions are being raised as to how and why the senator wasn't relieved from duty. The aide who co-signed the declaration of incompetence, Len Kuchar, chief of staff to the Liberal Senate leader, has yet to be reached for comment. Since the declaration of incompetence, Fairbairn was voted 12 times in the Senate and authorized more than $85,000 in spending, according to expense reports filed by her office. But she did travel less, spending under $4,000 from March to May, rather than her average $13,000. In the meantime, Senator Fairbairn will be taking an extended sick leave. It's unclear why she's taking the sick leave rather than stepping down.
The governing Ontario Liberals introduced legislation today to impose new contracts on thousands of Ontario school teachers. Dalton McGuinty's Liberals recalled the legislator 2 weeks early to introduce this bill, which freezes teachers' wages and cuts back on benefits. Education Minister Laurel Broughton said the bill ensures a school year free of labor disruptions, while teachers' unions condemn the legislation as unnecessary, saying the school year was never really in jeopardy. But the Liberals' minority government means they'll need support from other parties to pass the proposed legislation into law. The New Democrats have refused to support the bill. However, the Liberals have made concessions with regards to hiring procedures and diagnostic tests in order to craft the bill in a way that would please the Conservatives, who have said they will support the bill. On the off chance that the bill doesn't pass, the previous teacher's contract will roll over, giving them pay raises and benefits that the province says it can't afford.
A First Nation says Alberta's plan to balance the oil sands and the environment ignores the concerns of people who live in a remote northeastern region of Forest and Muskeg. The Athabasca Chipewyan say the plan puts forth some minor restrictions on oil sands development but does not protect their treaty rights or cultural livelihood. There are about 1,000 members of the First Nation living on four reserves in northeastern Alberta. The Lower Athabasca Regional Plan, announced Wednesday, creates new conservation zones but allows existing conventional oil and natural gas wells to continue operating in those areas. No oil sands development will be allowed in the zones unless access can be had from outside the boundaries through, for example, horizontal drilling. That means the government will begin talks with 17 energy companies on cancelling their leases and compensating them. No new tenures will be sold. The plan increases protected habitat for threatened woodland caribou by prohibiting energy and forest activity in the Dillon Reserve Conservation Region, which is expanded from 27,000 hectares to 192,000 hectares. The First Nation says the province has set weak environmental standards that won't do enough to protect caribou and other wildlife.
The Canadian Auto Workers Union has voted overwhelmingly in support of striking to back up their contract demands. Workers at Chrysler, General Motors, and Ford voted 99, 98, and 97% respectively to strike should contract negotiations fail. The CAW is looking for a bigger share of the Big Three automakers' improving financial situation after making concessions during the 2008 recession. While the companies are trying to trim their Canadian labor costs, the current contract expires on September 18th. Despite heavy-handed threats by union leaders, recent history does not look promising for the CAW. Generally, the word to workers of late has been simply to accept wage freezes and fewer benefits, a position the Ontario government is taking with its teachers, the BC government has taken with all of its public sector workers, and the big Detroit car companies are now making clear to their workers. The most severe case, however, has been the Caterpillar Incorporated's plant in Joliet, Illinois. After a 3.5-month strike, workers at Caterpillar agreed to freeze their wages for the next 6 years, notwithstanding the fact that the company posted a profit of nearly $5 billion last year. Ford and GM both netted profits surpassing that of Caterpillar last year, while Chrysler was able to turn a profit after losing over $600 million in 2010. For unions and their workers, these recent trends are threatening to undo 60 years of slow progress towards increased benefits and progressively higher wages. For employers, memories of the recession and the apparent fragility of the economy are lending enough leverage to hold the line on wages and roll back benefits.
And those are your provincial and national headlines here on News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. We are going to take a quick break, but do stay tuned for your weekday weather forecast and more international headlines.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
What do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca. I am your host, Chirag Mahajan.
I'm Mark Lemon. It's now time for your local weekday weather forecast with the fabulous Phil Chang. You there, Phil?
Oh, yeah. Oh. Hey, Martin. Hey, CJ.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
No problem.
Always a pleasure.
Good evening, listeners. So the expectations for some showers this week are quite high. They will be starting tomorrow, as we see there to be an upper air trough off passing through our region. Temperatures will be below par on the most part, and there will be a fair amount of cloud coverage, as well as the aforementioned showers of precipitation. Wind speeds will vary between 5-10 kilometers per hour, and the direction will be shifting depending on which part of the trough we're in. No, not trough, trough we're in. All right, great. Here is Vancouver's weather summary for the next 5 days. Tonight, partly cloudy, becoming very cloudy near midnight, low of 14. Tuesday, also cloudy, mix of sun and cloud, late in the morning, high of 2, heat index of 5 or moderate. Tuesday night, becoming cloudy late into the evening, 60% chance of showers for morning, low of 13. Wednesday, cloudy, 60% chance of showers, high of 20. And Friday, a mix of sun and cloud, low of 11, high of 18. So those are the figures provided to you by Environment Canada. Reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang from the UBC Storm Club.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you, CJ.
All right, looking forward to Friday. All right, so that was your weekday weather forecast brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. And it is now time for international headlines, and for that we go to Democracy Now.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A hurricane warning has been issued for the northern Gulf Coast as Tropical Storm Isaac looms over the Florida Panhandle up to Louisiana. Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi have declared states of emergency, leading to mandatory evacuations in low-lying coastal areas. The hurricane warning comes nearly 7 years to the day after Hurricane Katrina struck the Gulf Coast, devastating New Orleans. Isaac is headed to the Gulf Coast after battering Haiti and southern Florida. At least six deaths were reported in Haiti, which saw heavy flooding in the camps where some 400,000 survivors of the 2010 earthquake still live. Here in Florida, the storms led to the cancellation of today's first full day of the Republican National Convention. Republican spokesperson Kyle Downey said the convention will resume Tuesday.
We're in constant communication with state, federal, and local authorities, and, you know, we're going to make safety our primary concern, and we'll just see how things unfold. But, yeah, at this point, we're very confident that by Tuesday, we're going to be in great shape, and we'll kick off the convention.
Syrian government forces are being accused of committing what could be the deadliest massacre of Syria's 17-month-old conflict to date. On Saturday, activist groups said more than 300 bodies were found in homes around Raqqa, most of them showing signs of execution-style murder. Unverified video shows rows of bodies, including those of children, bloodied and wrapped in sheets. The killings occurred as the Syrian regime retook control of Raqqa after 3 days of fighting. The regime has denied responsibility and accused rebel forces of carrying out the massacre. Overall, activists say more than 400 people were killed across Syria Saturday, the country's bloodiest day since the conflict began. Dozens more were killed in violence Sunday. Earlier today, rebel forces claim responsibility for downing a Syrian military helicopter over Damascus. A new congressional study shows U.S. foreign weapons sales tripled last year to a record $66.3 billion, more than 75% of the total global weapons market. The Gulf regimes of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman bought U.S. arms at record levels. The British government has withdrawn its threat to seize WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange from his place of refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Ecuador says it received notice from Britain over the weekend that there's no threat to enter the embassy. Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa hailed the news.
We consider this unhappy incident to be over. A grave British diplomatic error, no? To say they are going to enter our embassy. But we consider this over. However, I hope the British don't distort what happened.
At least 39 people were killed in Venezuela Sunday in an explosion at the country's biggest refinery. It was the deadliest accident ever for Venezuela's oil industry. Israel's barred nearly 100 Palestinian solidarity activists from entering the occupied West Bank. The protesters, mostly from Europe, had tried to enter via the Allenby Bridge with Jordan. It was the latest effort by Israel to block a mass visit by international activists following the thwarting of a flotilla of thousands of people last year. One activist denied entry, said Israel's trying to block witnesses to the occupation.
They reject us because we openly say that we are in solidarity with Palestinians and because they don't want any witness to see what they are doing to Palestinians.
Two members of Russia's dissident band Pussy Riot have fled the country to avoid prosecution for a peaceful protest against Russian President Vladimir Putin inside an Orthodox church. Three members of the group were sentenced to 2 years in prison for the protest earlier this month. A judge rejected the argument their act was a form of political protest, instead ruling it was motivated by religious hatred. The two members who fled the country took part in the initial protest but have not been jailed. And the former U.S. astronaut Neil Armstrong has died at the age of 82. Armstrong was the first person ever on the moon, famously announcing what he called one giant leap for mankind on July 20th, 1969. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Democracy Now! Special coverage.
As Tropical Storm Isaac moves north, Gulf Coast communities are preparing. The National Hurricane Center has designated a significant storm surge threat to the northern Gulf Coast, and the National Guard has mobilized more than 4,000 troops in the region. In New Orleans, some schools have been closed, and authorities have called for mandatory evacuations in parts of Plaquemines, Low Jefferson, and St. Charles parishes. In Florida, Republicans canceled the first day of the convention, citing concerns about participants' safety. The delegates' roll call is now rescheduled for tomorrow. Florida's Governor Rick Scott canceled his convention appearances through Tuesday to focus on emergency response to Isaac. But ahead of the storm, protesters still rallied. More than 1,000 took to the streets of St. Petersburg yesterday in a symbolic farewell to democracy. As FSRN's Janelle Irwin reports, activists from the Occupy movement, labor unions, and veterans were among those who participated in the Death of Democracy March.
Many of the protesters arrived at St. Pete's Mirror Lake Park by bus. Some of them came from as far as California in support of the Occupy movement's 99%er philosophy. David Dembski carried a bouquet of black silk roses. He was there to march for the death of democracy, the theme of the demonstration.
We're finding out that the middle class is being going to lose a lot of rights, a lot of things that, you know, need to are human rights.
His wife, Dixie, sat beside him on a park bench overlooking the lake. She said a lot of the democratic injustices she sees are a result of the controversial Citizens United ruling that allows corporations to contribute unlimited funds into political campaigns. Super PACs alone have already spent more than $200 million this election cycle, according to the Center for Responsible Politics.
How can a decent person who doesn't have those kind of connections win an election? Even if we want them there, they saturate the market, they saturate the, and people will vote against their own best interests because they heard something on TV.
They marched from the park to the fenced-off public viewing area east of Tropicana Field, where delegates and media were being treated to dinner, drinks, and live entertainment. The so-called kickoff party welcomed Republicans and journalists to the four-day convention where former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney is expected to officially become the presidential nominee.
I think he has a lot of nerve running for president of the United States.
That was Jennifer Kenney, the Florida organizer for the Alliance for Retired Americans. She said she didn't like Romney from the start, but she was even more turned off when he chose Congressmember Paul Ryan as his running mate.
I think a lot of Americans aren't aware of that Paul Ryan is the author of this Ryan budget, which will actually end Medicare as we know it, force the working class people to work until they're 70 years of age before they'll be eligible for Social Security.
The event drew enough people to fill the street of one whole city block and then some. Organizers from the Florida Consumer Action Network, who planned a faith-based rally before marching, said they wanted the event to be family-friendly.
This is a very peaceful march. We are here to get our voices heard because these guys.
But their good intentions didn't stop the city of St. Petersburg from beefing up security in downtown. Barricades established a secured parade route for the group, and police officers stood in groups of 5 to 10 on every street corner along the path. Jay Shaft is an activist who has some experience with large-scale protests. He wore a shirt that said Cop Watch.
I felt to show up with the shirt today would at least give them a message. We're looking at you. You know, we're going to watch and see that you don't go crazy like in Miami and in Minnesota. I was in Minneapolis and in Denver, and it wasn't bad, but it was bad enough that it was brutal.
During the 2008 Republican National Convention in Minneapolis, videos surfaced of police officers using pepper spray and rubber bullets to subdue demonstrators. Officials here have claimed the revved-up police presence is only a precaution against so-called anarchists who come to cause problems. Justin is an anarchist who joined about a dozen others who wore all black and covered their faces with bandanas. He declined to give his last name.
No longer do we live in a democracy where we have a choice,
between anybody other than corporate person A or corporate person B. And Romney is one of the best examples of exactly that, is that we only have businessmen running the country, and all they care about is profit. And so we no longer live in a democracy.
Justin and the group of anarchists avoided being photographed with their faces showing. After the march went by without a peep from police, they locked arms and marched through the city along Central Avenue. Police quickly responded by creating roadblocks with their bikes, and the group dispersed. Janelle Irwin, FSRN, St. Petersburg.
This summer, the drought in the U.S. expanded across crucial farmland and turned more than half of all the nation's counties into disaster areas. According to the Department of Agriculture, 80% of agricultural land was hit by the drought. That could mean limited supply of key grain products and tough times for the rest of the world. Rising food prices are expected to spread throughout global markets and could present harsh conditions, especially to poor communities in Asia, Africa, and elsewhere. For more, we're joined by Michael Clare, professor at Hampshire College and author, most recently, of The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. Welcome to FSRN.
My pleasure.
The drought in the U.S. this year hit production of corn and soybeans especially hard. How could that affect consumers in the world market?
Well, bear in mind that the United States supplies about one-third of all grains available on the world marketplace. The U.S. is the world's biggest supplier to world food markets. So if the supply of grains from the United States diminishes, which it's sure to do as a result of the drought, that means that world food supplies will also contract, pushing prices up very much. And that will be a severe blow to global food availability and the ability of poor people around the world to acquire food at a reasonable price.
So if the U.S. is providing roughly one-third of that supply, what countries, what areas are especially vulnerable?
Well, those countries that rely on imported food, you know, countries that are self-sufficient in food, those, say, Brazil and Canada won't be so widely affected, but countries like Egypt and North African countries, Middle Eastern countries that are incapable of growing sufficient food for their population that must rely on imported food, they're going to see a steep rise in the price of their food imports. And this will trickle down to their population, which will have to pay more for food, basic food commodities. And many of the people in those countries are poor. They sometimes spend half or more of their family income on food products. So this is going to be a severe blow to the family income of poor people around the world. And if past history is any indication, this could lead to political unrest in many countries around the world.
Well, let's talk for a moment about that past history as we're talking about what could happen as a result of this drought. Let's talk about the food riots of 2008 when rice, corn, and wheat, there was a scarcity of those products. There was increased social pressure, and this unrest took place in countries in Africa and in Asia, and at least one place in Haiti, conditions related to the removal of a leader, the prime minister there. What happened then, and what does that tell us about conditions now?
In 2008, the price of basic foodstuffs, like you say, rice, corn, wheat, and so on, doubled in a very short space of time. And this was crippling to poor families in many parts of the world, like you said, in Haiti as well. And people were already suffering in many ways in those countries. And it triggered what were called food riots around the world in Cameroon and Pakistan, Bangladesh, and in Haiti. People were killed in many countries. There were clashes between these angry people, angry mobs, and the police, peacekeepers in Haiti, where five people died, and so forth. So this is the kind of thing we might expect again in the future.
And you make the interesting point that fast forward a couple years from that, Mohamed Bouazizi, the young man in Tunisia who set himself on fire and was a spark for uprisings in the region, was actually a food vendor, and circumstances were connected to food and economic market in that incident.
Yes. Again, in 2010 and 2011, that occurred in January 2011. The previous summer, there were terrible droughts around the world, including in Russia, which is again suffering from drought. That affected the wheat crop. There was already a lot of discontent. And the rising price of food combined with this existing discontent to trigger what we call the Arab Spring.
Now, looking ahead and how weather could affect food production, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration released a report this year analyzing extreme weather events of 2011 across the world. And one of the events they looked at was the drought in Texas. Last year, they found that the drought that hit Texas, it was 20 times more likely because of climate change. Moving forward, is the food production system prepared for changes in weather?
Absolutely not. We have a global food system that assumes a status quo in which there are good years and bad years, but they balance each other out so that in good years you could produce a surplus of food that will carry us through the bad years. But we're now entering a period where bad years are going to be the new norm, where droughts around the world will happen more and more frequently. So we'll never have good years. We'll never be able to build up a surplus of food sufficient to carry us through these bad years and address the problem of global hunger. That's what I fear, that climate change is going to completely cripple the global food production system, leading to widespread hunger, particularly in vulnerable areas like Africa, the Caribbean, Central Asia, South Asia. And this has potentially devastating consequences for world stability.
Michael Clare is the author most recently of The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He's also a professor at Hampshire College. He joined us to discuss extreme weather and the effects on global food production. Michael Clare, thanks for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Advocates calling for reforms to the drug policies in Mexico and the U.S. are crossing through Texas today. The Trans-Border Caravan for Peace and Justice passed through Laredo yesterday and is headed next to San Antonio, Houston, and New Orleans. The campaign is calling attention to the drug war in Mexico that has killed more than 60,000 and displaced and disappeared tens of thousands more. Participants want the U.S. and Mexican governments to end practices that they say have led to the rise in organized crime and incarceration. Calls for reform on drug policy are also taking shape in other countries throughout Latin America. In Brazil, religious leaders, health advocates, and law enforcement groups have met in the capital this week to outline changes to a 2006 drug law in the country that they say has led to mass incarceration and had a heavy toll on poor urban residents. Since the law took effect, the number of people put in prison for possessing drugs has doubled to about 120,000. Many are first-time offenders, according to the Brazilian Commission on Drugs and Democracy. For more, we're joined by Ruben Cesar Fernandez. He's executive secretary with the Brazilian Commission, one of the groups calling for reform. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for calling.
According to data from the Research Group on Drug Policy and Human Rights at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro, since 2005, the number of people behind bars for drug crimes has increased. In 2005, it was 1 in 10 prisoners. In 2009, that had changed, had risen to 1 in 5 prisoners were there for drug offenses. How has this drug law changed criminal proceedings and punishment since it went into effect?
Well, certainly, we did not have such a dramatic growth in drug consumption. Certainly, there's no rise in crime. On the contrary, there's a tendency for the crime rates to go down in Brazil. So the question is that you have lots of people who are actually consumers being arrested as if they were somehow associated with drug dealing, with criminal offenses. And those, there is a research by the Ministry of Justice, and right now talking to you within the Ministry of Justice of Brazil, this ministry did a research on the sentences, who's being sentenced by the court on drug offenses, and it turns out that a vast majority, we're speaking about young people who come from very poor neighborhoods, favelas we call them, mostly black, and with no prior penal history, with no prior visiting to police districts or processing before, so they are primary, you know, the first time they are arrested, and with no guns, with no connection, obvious connections to any kind of organized crime. So the question is, if you are arrested, if you are, you know, if you have a police occurrence in a poor neighborhood, the chances of the police name you as someone who's associated with drug dealing, with organized crime, is very high. If you are in a middle-class neighborhood, you would be rather classified mostly as a consumer, right?
So there is this discrepancy and disproportionate impact on poor residents. How do you see that playing out in the communities you work in, or where you have clinics in some of these poor neighborhoods, especially in Rio de Janeiro?
The law is ambiguous. The law is vague in some key points. So the police officers who are in patrol, they in the end are called to make decisions, you know. Is this person a dealer or just one more consumer? And so that's the question a police officer is forced to make to him or herself every day, you know. And so since the consumption is very spread out, it's a ant kind of phenomenon, it's all over, especially with young people, the police forces are so much taken by this kind of question that it's not good for security, it's not good for them.
We're reaching you by mobile phone. You're there in Brasilia at the Ministry of Justice. You've been meeting with lawmakers, and you're proposing a new bill to address some of these concerns. What are some of the specific reforms that you're calling for?
We are proposing very simple things. We're not trying to be very radical. We are trying to get a consensus, kind of a base proposals, which can rally, you know, various segments of the population. So we are saying take it out of the penal system, bring it up to the health system, and take it out from jail, and bring it to church, to school, to the clinic. So that's the basic idea. To do that, we must be able to differentiate in practice who is a consumer and who is a dealer. We have two houses in Brazil, so it must go through the two houses and end up with the President of the Republic signing the bill. So it's a process. We believe this is a discussion which should take us up to, you know, March, April of next year.
So possibly changes to legislation or new legislation March, April 2013.
Mid-2013 should have a new law.
Ruben Cesar Fernandez is Executive Secretary with the Brazilian Commission on Drugs and Democracy. He joined us from Brasilia by mobile phone to discuss efforts to reform drug policy in the country. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for calling.
On its way to the Gulf Coast, Tropical Storm Isaac did not reach full hurricane strength, but still battered parts of the Dominican Republic and Haiti, where hundreds of thousands of people are still living in vulnerable tent camps. The storm caused 19 deaths, 22 injuries, and forced the evacuation of nearly 16,000 from homes and temporary shelters, according to Haiti's Ministry of the Interior. Humanitarian groups are now raising concerns about flooding and extensive damage to bridges, roads, and food crops. The storm is also drawing more attention to the severe housing crisis in the country. For more, we're joined by Alexis Irkut with Other Worlds, a social and economic justice group. She's also an organizer with Under Tents, an international campaign working for housing rights for people displaced in Haiti. She joins us from Port-au-Prince. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How has this latest storm affected the thousands of people who are still living in temporary shelters or tents?
So probably in the camps where we work, where we have kind of grassroots housing activists that are active, probably a half to two-thirds in some camps of their shelters have been destroyed. So people are without any kind of protection from country storms. I mean, people that are already, in a sense, homeless are now really without any kind of shelter.
So if it's a half to two-thirds of people are displaced from their tents, what are their options? Where can they go?
Well, that's the dilemma. Most of the people, at this point, 2.5 years after the earthquake, people that are still living in tent camps, and the conditions in camps are deplorable. They're really, really difficult. And people are there because they don't have anywhere else to go. Camps have been systematically evicted over the last 2 years. And when people are evicted, I mean, they may find other family members to live with, or there's a huge push on the outskirts of the city to the north. People are moving essentially into the desert and trying to build shelters out of tarps or scrap metal that they could scrounge up. Probably about 60,000 people are settling north of the city right now. Many of those shelters were also destroyed in the storm. So that's kind of the million-dollar question right now, is what's going to happen to people and where will they go?
The UN says 400,000 people are still without permanent houses. We're now entering the third hurricane season since the 2010 earthquake. What is the latest on the housing crisis overall for residents in Haiti?
That's been a real challenge. I would say in the lack of access to safe, affordable housing has been a problem. Even since before the earthquake, on the eve of the earthquake, surveys showed that there was a lack of 300,000 houses in the Port-au-Prince area. The earthquake damaged 175,000 more. And since the earthquake, only about 5,500 houses have been built. Those figures really, really reveal what a shortage of housing homeless patients are facing. And I'm just looking right now at the latest figures from Haiti's Civil Protection Office, and it looks like another 300 some houses have been destroyed in this storm and more than 2,000 damaged. So it's a situation that both the government and international community have largely overlooked.
Alexis Irkut is with Other Worlds. That's a social and economic justice group. She spoke to us by mobile phone from Port-au-Prince, Haiti, about the housing crisis and the damage from Tropical Storm Isaac. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
As the government of Quebec, Canada prepares for elections in early September, students continue to pressure elected leaders to roll back fee hikes and anti-protest laws. Thousands of students and their allies marched in Montreal Wednesday, and many remain on strike. FSRN's Lillian Bachter has more.
Waving flags and wearing the now iconic red squares of fabric, demonstrators were in high spirits as they marched through downtown Montreal. Protesters are calling for an end to Premier Jean Charest's Liberal government, which enforced a 75% fee hike on students and enacted Law 12, which curtails freedom of assembly. Camille Robert is the spokesperson of CLASS, the largest student association involved in the protests.
We denounce the neoliberal measures that have been taken by the Liberal government in the past years. But for us, it is not just about one political party. It is not only about the Liberal Party.
More than 43,000 students remain on an unlimited general strike. Students hope they can pressure politicians ahead of September 4th provincial elections. Political debates during the election period have largely avoided any discussion of education in Quebec or the question of student fee hikes, as well as the deeper societal issues brought forward by the student movement. Fernand Deschamps is an elementary school science teacher and is a candidate for Quebec's Marxist-Leninist Party.
How come in a Quebec so rich with natural resources that people cannot decide, first and foremost, the workers who extract them from the soil? Why can't they have a say in how all these riches, this wealth, can be redistributed for the well-being of everyone?
Students also say electoral discussions are failing to include key policy reforms that could help address inequalities. Ricardo Lamour is a social service student at the University of Montreal.
We need, as a society, to be concerned by the unconscious exclusion of minorities in all the electoral discussion that we're having right now. I mean, we're not all equal here. It is a lie.
Another protester, University of Quebec at Trois-Rivières student Anne-Julie Durocher, says she doesn't have much faith in the most popular political parties. She says their policies don't reflect what students want.
Many of the parties that have the chance to win in the elections are proposing a sort of fee hike. For us, it does not matter what kind of hike. It will affect the accessibility to education for students, and that is why our mobilization will continue on September 5th.
The right-leaning party, Coalition for the Future of Quebec, would also impose a fee hike on students, and the Parti Québécois has plans to freeze the hike but then hold a general assembly, which may introduce a cost-of-living increase or another type of fee hike. Demonstrators cheered in support of Quebec Solidaire National Assembly member Amir Khadid as he passed through the crowds. His party advocates for free post-secondary education in Quebec.
We are here and we will win. Strike or no strike, we will win. We will provide free education. In 3 years, we would put a capital tax on banks and financial institutions that would ensure free education. Whether the Liberal Party, the Parti Québécois, or the CAQ wins the election, the popular movement behind the students will win. We will have free university.
Law 12, previously known as Law 78, forced students back to class in August to make up for lost classes earlier in the year. It also imposes stiff fines and penalties on student associations that do not return to class. Thousands of students voted to end the strike and return to class until the election, at which time they will decide on their next steps. The new fee hikes are already in place, and many students will have to pay their tuition by the end of August. Even though the student strikes have not yet succeeded in blocking the fee hike, the ongoing student movement has affected other parts of society. Elise Ross was at the protest with members of her neighborhood assembly, which meet regularly to decide on issues facing their community.
I'm participating in a neighborhood assembly that was built throughout the student movement. The power is closer to me and we decide together, so it's like direct democracy, which I think is more interesting than this electoral system we have right now.
This week's protest marked the sixth monthly mass demonstration on the 22nd of each month. Lillian Bachter, FSRN, Montreal.
And thank you very much to both Democracy Now! And Free Speech Radio News for bringing us our international headlines and as well as our international news in general. The daily newscast can be found at democracynow.org and fsrn.org, respectively. You are listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that is our program for Monday, August 27th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Mark Lumlin. Thank you very much for listening to us, and stay tuned for the best of sore throats clapping hands.